Good evening. I'm Diane Wachowski, the poet in residence at Michigan State. And it is indeed a privilege this evening to have as our guest poet Stephen Dunn, reading his work in conjunction with having judged the Jim Cash Poetry Contest this year. It's customary for the literary awards to be read and judged by one judge each year, but this year, due to the press of Mr. Dunn's schedule, he read only the poetry submissions, but there were a huge number of them. Generous members of the MSU faculty, Leonora Smith, and Leonora, where are you? Hooray. Leonora Smith and Mike Steinberg, who is teaching a class, have judged the essay and fiction contests. And before I introduce Stephen Dunn and his poetry, I'm sure you'll be happy to know that I'm going to announce the winners of all the contests this year. Get ready. I'm going to start with the Jim Cash Poetry Contest, which was judged by Stephen Dunn. The first prize of $150 goes to Angela Vasquez Giroux for her poem Triptych in the Key of D Minor, about which Stephen Dunn wrote, a beautifully paced and modulated poem, its music conceit delicately and surprisingly handled throughout. There's a voice and intelligence so nicely converging here. Congratulations. You want to stand up? The second prize of $100 in the Jim Cash Poetry Contest goes to Sarah Sword for a group of three of her poems, The Economics of an Etch-a-Sketch Body, Why I'll Never Ask You to Quit Smoking, and Autumn Villanelle. About Sarah Sword's poem, Stephen Dunn wrote, these strong poems are clearly by the same person. If I'm wrong, then I choose the Villanelle as the winner of the second prize. But together they show their author to be someone with something to say and the linguistic and formal means with which to say it. Congratulations, Sarah. Stand up. Third prize of $50 goes to, I don't think he's here tonight, Sean Hain. He actually is playing in a jazz group and he had to substitute for somebody, so he had to be in Royal Oaks at 6 o'clock. Stephen Dunn says about, The title of Sean Hain's poem is Stephen Dunn, Do You See What They're Doing? About this poem, Stephen Dunn wrote, shameless of me, perhaps, to choose this one, but I found the energy and the chutzpah in it to be irresistible, even if its author sometimes has moments of syntactical awkwardness. The poem is full of good humor and pizzazz. In addition, while there is no monetary prize for these students, Stephen Dunn selected three poems to be named as honorable mentions. I'd just like to say that there were 180 poems submitted in this contest, so you should all feel that the poems selected from this group truly had to be outstanding, displaying great skill and talent. And in fact, if you lost, you shouldn't feel badly. It's like all those things at the Academy Awards when they say, I was so honored to be in this pool of candidates. The poems selected for honorable mention were Window Fixing by Bradley Leap. Is Bradley here? Great name. And two poems by Timothy Carmody, Horn and Detroit Bar. Is Timothy here? Stand up. Congratulations to all six of these poets on their fine work. And thank you, Stephen. This year, Mike Steinberg agreed to judge the essay contest, and though there is only one prize for a winner, Professor Steinberg, who is the editor of our creative nonfiction journal, selected two recipients to split the prize. They are Scott P. Drake for the essay entitled Where the Wild Pigeons Were. Scott, are you here? About this essay, Mike Steinberg wrote, I like the writer's use of language, the precise detail, and the evocation of place. And the co-winner is Ryan Zernak. Ryan, are you here? They must be at the basketball game. For the essay entitled The Soul's Fire, about which Mike Steinberg wrote, the writer creates an evocative mood and landscape that borders on the edge of reality and dream. This year, there are two fiction contests, as the Swarthout Concert, the Swarthout Prize alternates annually between poetry and fiction. We were fortunate to be able to persuade Leonora Smith of the AT&L faculty, herself an accomplished fiction writer, to read and judge this year's short stories. And the winners are. But first, Professor Smith wrote that she judged the stories by how the writers accomplished what their stories promised. She was guided by John Gardner's notion of fiction as, quote, a vivid, continuous dream in the reader's mind, unquote. The winners of the Glendon and Catherine Swarthout Fiction Contest this year are, first place, and I know he isn't here because he just won a prize in poetry, Sean Hain, for his story, One Afternoon I Quit Spitting. About this, Leonora Smith wrote, an interesting feat. The writer kept me engaged in a story told by a main character who, though an astute observer, is morally vacuous. First prize of $150 to Sean Hain. Second place in the Glendon Swarthout contest of $100 goes to Meg McClure for her story, Verticality. Is Meg here tonight? Hey. Professor Smith's simple comment was, tone perfect. Though she also felt that this short story belonged in the essay category. Third place in the Glendon Swarthout prize contest for a $50 prize is a tie between two stories, A Cheerleader and Cigarettes by Daniel Reese Mills. Are you here, Daniel? And Hell's Placement Test by Greg Wright. Is Greg Wright here? All right. Leonora Smith wrote two realist stories particularly effective at creating settings and conflicts with a contemporary feel. The Jim Cash Awards in Fiction went to, first place, $150, Jonathan P. Mazal for The River. Is Jonathan here? Professor Smith wrote a poetic and ambitious story that uses multiple points of view to build a reality. Second place in the Jim Cash Fiction Contest for $100 goes to The Fairgrounds by Catherine Marcuse. Is she here? Oh, all these absent women. Ireland, well, that's a good excuse. And Leonora Smith wrote, this is a well-plotted piece in the O. Henry vein. Third place in the Jim Cash Fiction Awards goes to Terry Powell for his story, Animals Which Exist in Fire. Terry, are you here tonight? Says the judge, imaginative, begins in the dailiness of work and slips into the realm of fantasy science fiction. Though there is no monetary prize for honorable mention, there was one awarded in this contest, and it goes to Jeremy D. Campbell for his short story called Violent Story. Jeremy, are you here? Stand up. Congratulations. Let me repeat what a pleasure and privilege it is for the English department to host Stephen Don tonight. He was willing to come for a small fee and lots of work because he's a nice guy from New Jersey, and he's currently a visiting poet in the MFA program at U of M in Ann Arbor. Stephen Dunn is the author of 11 collections of poems, the most recent of which is Different Hours, published by Norton. His 1996 collection, Loose Strife, was nominated and became a finalist for a National Book Critics Circle Award, while his 1986 collection, From Morrow, Local Time, was a winner of the National Poetry Series competition. Some of you are familiar with the poems from this collection, Local Time, because I've been reading my favorites to you during the past few weeks. In addition, Stephen Dunn has won, yes, I am not kidding, an Academy Award in literature. This is not an Oscar, actually. It's an award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, but equally prized by poets. And of course, he has won many other prizes, namely the much coveted Levinson, as well as the Oscar Blumenthal prizes from Poetry Magazine. Stephen Dunn is a bit of a chameleon as a poet. He can do many things, though like another Eastern Seaboard poet whom I admire, Louis Simpson, Dunn is precise and movingly a writer of middle-class American experiences. I was rather bemused when I found in a HarperCollins poetry textbook Stephen Dunn being described as a confessional poet, along with Sharon Olds. But I suspect that's what editors were alluding to was the ability that Dunn has for finding a moment of intimacy in our everyday lives, focusing on it and imbuing it with a sexuality or eroticism of human experience. Not quite what the term confessional means historically. I think this rather strange designation points to the fact that Americans are gossips and storytellers, and we have a hard time defining this in terms of poetry. But we love the poets who find elegant ways to offer us their buzz. Perhaps we could say that the mainstream of American poetry in the past 25 years has gathered up and made visible how much Americans like to participate in people's intimate, secret, or hidden emotions about themselves or about other human beings. Despite modernist and postmodernist theories of impersonality, the mainstream of American poetry adheres to the personal, the familial, and the revelations that our private thoughts can offer. Stephen Dunn writes out of his family life, his male life, his pleasure in finding something metaphysical, metaphorical, or extraordinary in the everyday. His poetry is filled with quiet awe as well as jovial acceptance. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Stephen Dunn to the campus of Michigan State University this evening.
I don't think I need this. I have this magic thing here. Can you hear me way back there? Good. Thank you very much, Diane. That was thoughtful and eloquent, I think. I was thinking of what poem to start with tonight, and I want to read mostly from my new book, Different Hours, but I think given Diane's introduction and actually I was interviewed by Heather Moreland this afternoon, who asked me a number of intelligent questions, really good questions. And one of the poems that she liked was this poem, A Good Life, which I really haven't read in years. And I thought I would start with it. And it has to do with what Diane alluded to, a certain middle-class life. I suspect I'm one of the few poets in the country who would actually admit he has a good life. Maybe you don't. It's not good form to do that, and you get nothing out of admitting such a thing. But in fact, I do. But those of us who have such a thing always know that there's an underside to it. And I think one of my subjects has always been the underside of a good life. A good life. It was on evenings like this, in spite of the good talk and drink, no more love worries than usual, and a fine commotion of crickets in the late summer heat. It was on evenings like this he knew his true life lay elsewhere. It must. So much acceptable pleasure here, yet so much yearning. He was home, some muted pinprick of unease prodding him dully from afar. He told a story about a black bear who swam the Delaware water gap to get to New Jersey, where bears can't be hunted, a story of animal wisdom, survival, as if the bear knew, as if there were a secret network of bears. His guests were pleased. The state of Pennsylvania wanted its bear returned. In fact, New Jersey owed them 9 bears. There was proof. Like certain departures, betrayals, it became a matter for the courts, the rights of bears, of hunters, bureaucrats. You can walk out of your life if sadness properly instructs you. And can't humiliation send you knees bleeding over the forbidden wall? That's what he was thinking as his wife poured more wine for the guests, as a beneficent moon half-lit the yard, and the erotics of friendship made its edgy argument against despair. The guests left. It was time. He and his wife cleaned up, talked, made sweet drunken love. Nothing was wrong. Nothing was wrong except there was this life intuited, unclaimed. He suspected she sensed it too, hers, something more utterly hers. Elsewhere, bears were trusting their bodies to take them to safety. But what did bears know about water and wind and chance? He could see a bear caught in turbulence, swept down river, where no law could keep it from being killed. It's a comedy, he thought. His hand was resting on her hip. It could be anybody's hip, anybody's hand. In a dream, Stendhal heard Don Juan speak. There are not 20 different sorts of women, and once you've had 2 or 3 of each sort, boredom sets in. To which Stendhal said, "A man who trembles isn't bored." Maybe it was all about trembling, some old trepidation before the next step. Maybe, like Stendhal, you connive to give yourself a wake-up call in the middle of the night. He kissed her, and in the settled dark, rolled away into the other world of their bed. It was easy. No, that was not applause coming from the crickets. He understood that relentless buzz, more than mere desire, less than misery. I have a couple of villanelles. Oh, okay. Okay. Good. For Sarah. Okay. Have to find it. You remember some years ago what happened with the figure skaters, with the Nancy Kerrigan and time? Yeah. I'm afraid this poem is going to become quickly dated, so I'm happy that you asked me to read it. Criminal. One woman has nothing out of place as she slides into our living rooms. The other can't control her face. The past is in it, and something cheap insists on the wrong expensive gowns. Unnerving, though, nothing out of place. We know no one is quite that chaste. Always near the palace are the ruins. The other can't control her face, yet it's so hard for us to embrace her, even broken-laced and fallen. One woman has nothing out of place, and more unfair, she's all art and excellence. Turn away, egalitarians. The other who never learned to control her face applauds politely, smiles. What grace she's willed only lasts seconds. One is beautiful, has nothing out of place. The other can't control her face. Well, my book, Different Hours, I don't want to be reductive about it, really, but there's a couple of kind of poems in here, maybe more than that, but some that are historical about the different hours I and others have lived with and through, and others I think are more psychological. I'll start with a few that are a little more historical. I came of age In the Eisenhower years, in the 50s. And when I began this poem, which is called Simpler Times, I began it, I think, with the notion that, in fact, I did live in simpler times. It's very easy to think such things. The poem would not allow me to keep that intention. Simpler times. The violent boys merely armed with fists, the president avuncular, his office unspoiled. It's tempting to believe we lived in simpler times. Unfulfillment didn't have its high priests, not even a language. I just thought of it as family life or school, and on Sunday nights ran in from the clean, safe streets to laugh at Milton Berle. I wanted to be a regular guy, she a popular girl. That night she babysat, oh, a breast never again would be that sufficient or that bare. I stopped right there. Nearby were the slums just beyond our caring, and nearer still, it took years to hear it, a complaint rising to a howl. In Hungary, the tanks rolled in. In Zaire, Mobutu filled the secret underground jails. I think all you have to do is just torque your perspective a little bit historically, and you know there was never anything like simpler times. It may have been in my neighborhood, but not in Hungary and not other places. I think all of us who are poets have our stories about how we became such. Most of them, of course, are half-truths. Most people have no idea why they became poets, I'm quite sure. Though I have always liked the stories that people tell. And this is at least a story that preceded me becoming a poet. It's about quitting a corporate job. I had, in New York, a corporate job at which I was alarmingly successful. I kept on getting promoted all the time, so I quit. The last hours. There's some innocence left, and these are the last hours of an empty afternoon at the office, and there's the clock on the wall, and my friend Frank in the adjacent cubicle selling himself on the phone. I'm 25 on the shaky ladder up, my father's son, corporate, clean-shaven, and I know only what I don't want, which is almost everything I have. A meeting ends, men in serious suits, intelligent men who've been thinking hard about marketing snacks, move back now to their window offices, worried or proud. The big boss, Horace, had called them in to approve this, reject that. The big boss, a first name, how's your family kind of assassin who likes me. It's 1964, the 60s haven't begun yet. Cuba is a larger name than Vietnam. The Soviets are behind everything that could be wrong. Where I sit, it's exactly 19 minutes to 5. My phone rings. Horace would like me to stop in before I leave. Stop in, code words, leisurely words that mean now. Would I be willing to take on this? Would X's office, who by the way is no longer with us, be satisfactory? About money, will this be enough? I smile, I say yes and yes and yes, but I don't know from what calm place this comes. I'm translating his beneficence into a life of selling snacks, talking snack strategy, thinking snack thoughts. On the elevator down, it's a small knot, I'd like to say, of joy. That's how I tell it now, here in the future, the fear long gone. By the time I reach the subway, it's gone. It's outsized, an attitude finally come round. And I say it quietly to myself, I quit, and keep saying it, knowing I will say it, sure of nothing else but. As a college student in the 50s, living through that, I had the luck of being a graduate student in the late 60s, when a lot of stuff was happening, as you know. This poem is called The Sexual Revolution. And it's like one of those great tags, those great historical tags, of course, that certainly there was a sexual revolution, and as we know, probably many people weren't getting any during it. I, fortunately, was not one of those people. The sexual revolution. In that time of great freedom to touch and get in touch, we lived on the prairie amid polite moral certainty. The sensate world seemed elsewhere and was. On our color television, the president's body admitted he was lying. There was marching in the suddenly charged streets and what a girl in a headband and miniskirt called communication. A faraway friend wrote, to say the erotic life was the only life. Get with it, he said. But many must have been slow-witted during the Age of Enlightenment, led artless lives during the Golden Age. We watched the revolution on the evening news. It was 1972 when the 60s reached all the way to where we were. The air became alive with incense and license. The stores sold permission. And I bought and my wife bought until we were left with almost nothing. Even the prairie itself changed. People began to call it the land. And once again, it was impossibly green and stretched endlessly ahead of us. Before the sky darkens. Sunsets, incipient storms, the tableaus of melancholy. Maybe these are the Saturday night events to take your best girl to. At least then there might be moments of vanishing beauty before the sky darkens, and the expectation of happiness would hardly exist, and therefore might be possible. More and more you learn to live with the unacceptable. You sense the ever-hidden God retreating even farther, terrified or embarrassed. You might as well be a clown, big silly clothes, no evidence of desire. That's how you feel, say, on a Tuesday. Then out of the daily wreckage comes an invitation with your name on it, or more likely that best girl of yours offers you, once again, a small local kindness. You open your windows to good air blowing in from who knows where, who knows where, which you gulp and deeply inhale as if you have a death sentence. You have. All your life, it seems, you've been appealing it. Night sweats and useless stratagem, reprieve. Year or so ago, I reached the age that no male in my family has ever reached. And therefore, of course, I never expected to reach it, and always, I think, lived my life that way. And very few of the women in our family made it out of their 50s. So this poem was written as a little birthday present to myself, 60. Because in my family, the heart goes first and hardly anybody makes it out of his 50s, I think I'll stay up late with a few bandits of my choice and resist good advice. I'll invent a secret scroll lost by Egyptians and reveal its contents, the directions to your house, recipes for forgiveness. History says my ventricles are stone alleys, my heart itself a city with a terrorist holed up in the mayor's office. I'm in the mood to punctuate only with that maker of promises, the colon. Next, 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 it says, God bless it. As Garcia Lorca may have written, Some people forget to live as if a great arsenic lobster could fall on their heads at any moment. My 60th birthday is tomorrow. Come play poker with me. I want to be taken to the cleaners. I've had it with all stingy-hearted sons of bitches. A heart is to be spent. As for me, I'll share my mulcher with anyone who needs to mulch. It's time to give up the search for the invisible. On the best of days, there's little more than the faintest intimations. The millennium, my dear, is sure to disappoint us. I think I'll keep on describing things to ensure that they really happened. I'm sure many of you know one of Socrates' great aphorisms, the unexamined life is not worth living. Something I've always held dear. This poem begins with a quote that might be its antithesis and its companion at the same time. It's from the Portuguese poet Fernando Pessoa. Life would be unbearable if we made ourselves conscious of it. At the restaurant. Six people are too many people in a public place, the wrong place for what you're thinking. Stop this now. Who do you think you are? The duck a l'orange is spectacular, the flan the best in town. But there among your friends is the unspoken as ever, chatter and gaiety its familiar song. And there's your chronic emptiness spiraling upward in search of words you'll dare not say without irony. You should have stayed at home. It's part of the social contract to seem to be where your body is. And you've been elsewhere like this, for Christ's sake, countless times. Behave, feign. Certainly you believe a part of decency is to overlook, to let pass. Praise the Caesar salad, praise Susan's black dress, Paul's promotion and raise. Inexcusable the slaughter in this world, insufficient the merely decent man. Old dogs. Those Trotskys of relationships, perpetual revolution their motto, their impatient hearts dangerous to all that's complacent, I understand them perfectly, and also why someone they've left behind might travel all the way to Mexico with a pickaxe to put an end to things. It's human nature, after all, to want to put an end to things and to start up again. Because you can't teach old dogs new tricks, Dinah Washington said, you got to get yourself some new dogs. She was explaining her eight husbands, and this was an argument for nine. If I'd known any one of her old dogs, no doubt I'd understand why he might have just wanted to lie on the couch and go for short walks. I've wanted to do nothing as often as I've wanted to rise up, rush into the night. Falling in love produces such anxiety, my friend says. Thank God there's sex for some occasional repose. He lives for scattered episodes with one woman at a time. I understand that too. As I understand year after year, doing a few same things in the same house with the same person, settled and unsettled, in for the long haul. What goes on? After the affair and the moving out, after the destructive, revivifying passion, we watched her life quiet into a new one, her lover more and more on its periphery. She spent many nights alone, happy for the narcosis of the television. When she got cancer, she kept it to herself until she couldn't keep it from anyone. The chemo debilitated and saved her, and one day her husband asked her to come back, his wife, who, after all, had only fallen in love as anyone might who hadn't been in love in a while. And he held her so different now, so thin, her hair just partially grown back. He held her like a new woman, and what she felt felt almost as good as love had. And each of them called it love because precision didn't matter anymore. And we who'd been part of it, often rejoicing with one and consoling the other, we who had seen her truly alive and then merely alive, what could we do but revise our phone book, our hearts, offer a little toast to what goes on? One of the startling things for me of the past century was that God didn't die. It seems one of the most extraordinary things. I was sure Nietzsche was right. But he was wrong. Interestingly, so this is called the death of God. When the news filtered to the angels, they were overwhelmed by their sudden aloneness. Long into the night, they waited for instructions. The night was quieter than any night they'd known. I don't have a thought in my head, one angel lamented. Others worried, is there such a thing as an angel now? New to questioning, dashed by the dry light of reason, some fell into despair, many disappeared. A few wandered naturally toward power, were hired by dictators who needed something like an angel to represent them to the world. These angels spoke the pure secular word. They murdered sweetly and extolled the greater good. The dark angel himself was simply amused. The void grew and was fabulously filled. Vast stadiums and elaborate malls, the new cathedrals, were built where people cheered and consumed. At the nostalgia shops, angel trinkets and plastic crucifixes lined the shelves. The old churches were homes for the poor. And yet, before meals and at bedtime, and in the iconographies of dreams, God took his invisible place in the kingdom of need. Disaffected minstrels made and sang his songs. The angels were given breath and brain. This all went on while he was dead to the world. The dark angel observed it, waiting as ever. On these things, his entire existence depended. Well, maybe a little change of tone here. It's a new book. I have to look it up in the index. This poem has an epigraph from a freshman's short story. John and Mary had never met. They were like two hummingbirds who also had never met. John and Mary. They were like gazelles who occupied different grassy plains, running in opposite directions from different lions. They were like postal clerks in different zip codes with different vacation time, their bosses adamant and clock-driven. How could they get together? They were like two people who couldn't get together. John was a Sufi with a love of the dervish, Mary, of course, a Christian with a curfew. They were like two dolphins in the immensity of the Atlantic, one playful, the other stuck in a tuna net, two absolutely different childhoods. There was simply no hope for them. They would never speak in person. When they ran across that windswept field toward each other, they were like two freight trains, one having left Seattle at 6:36 p.m. at an unknown speed, the other delayed in Topeka for repairs. The math indicated that they'd embrace in another world, if at all, like parallel lines, or merely appear kindred and close, like stars. Well, I've taught creative writing for many years. It's a term I don't much like. It seems much too generic. I think what we do is kind of shepherd people into writing better poems and stories. And it seems, I suspect that the art of it is something like telling people the truth and still keeping them alive. So that may be much too serious an introduction for this poem. Decorum. She wrote, "They were making love up against the gymnasium wall, and another young woman in class, serious enough to smile, said, 'No, that's fucking. They must have been fucking.' To which many agreed, pleased to have the proper fit of word with act. But an older woman, a wife, a mother, famous in the class for confusing grace with decorum and carriage, said the F word would distract the reader, sensationalize the poem. Why can't what they were doing just as easily be called making love?" It was an intelligent complaint, and the class proceeded to debate what's fucking, what's making love, and the importance of context, tact, the bon mot. I leaned toward those who favored fucking. They were funnier and seemed to have more experience with the happy varieties of their subject. But then a young man said, now believing he had permission, "What's the difference? You fuck them and you call it making love. You tell them what they want to hear." The class jeered, and another man said, "You're the kind of guy who gives fucking a bad name." And I remembered how fuck gets dirty as it moves reptilian out of certain minds, certain mouths. The young woman whose poem it was, small-boned and small-voiced, said she had no objection to fucking, but these people were making love. It was her poem, and she herself up against that gymnasium wall, and it felt like love, and the hell with all of us. There was silence. The class turned to me, their teacher, who they hoped could clarify, perhaps ease things. I told them I disliked the word fucking in a poem, but that fucking might be right in this instance, yet I was unsure now. I couldn't decide. A tear formed and moved down the poet's cheek. I said I was sure only of gymnasium, sure it was the wrong choice, making the act seem too public, more vulgar than she wished. "How about boathouse?" I said. Well, I turned to this one, so I'll read it. Oklahoma City. The accused chose to plead innocent because he was guilty. We allowed such a thing. It was one of our greatnesses, nutty, protective. On the car radio, a survivor's ordeal. Her leg amputated without anesthesia while trapped under a steel girder. Simply, no big words. That's how people tell their horror stories. I was elsewhere on my way to a party. On arrival, everyone was sure to be carrying a piece of the awful world with him. Not one of us wouldn't be smiling. There'd be drinks, irony, hidden animosities. Something large would be missing, but most of us would understand something large always would be missing. Oklahoma City was America reduced to McVeigh's half-thought-out thoughts. Did he know anything about suffering? It's the naive among us who are guilty of wondering if we're moral agents or madmen, or merely, as one scientist said, a fortuitous collocation of atoms. Some mysteries can be solved by ampersands, ands, not ors. That was my latest answer. At the party, two women were talking about how strange it is that they still like men. They were young and unavailable, and their lovely faces evoked a world not wholly incongruent with the world I know. I had no illusions, not even hopes, that their beauty had anything to do with goodness. The reverse side. This has a an epigraph from a Japanese proverb. The reverse side also has a reverse side. It's why when we speak a truth, some of us instantly feel foolish, as if a deck inside us has been shuffled. And there it is, the opposite of what we said. And perhaps why, as we fall in love, we're already falling out of it. It's why the terrified and the simple latch on to one story, just one version of the great mystery, image and after image. Oh, even the open-minded yearn for a fiction to rein things in, the snapshot, the lie of a frame. How do we not go crazy, we who have found ourselves compelled to live with the circle, the ellipses, the word not yet written? Different hours. As the small plane descended through the "it's all over now" Sturm und Drang, I closed my eyes and saw myself in waves of lucidity, a vanisher in the long process of vanishing, of solitary character, truant heart. When we landed, I flipped down my daily mask, resumed my normal dreamy life of uncommitted crimes. I held nothing against me anymore. And now, next day, I wake before the sound of traffic, amazed that the paper has been delivered, that the world is up and working. A dazed rabbit sits in the dewy grass. The clematis has no aspirations as it climbs its trestle. I pour myself orange juice, home style. I say the hell with low-fat cream cheese and slather the good stuff on my bagel. The newspaper seems to be thinking my thoughts. No hope for lost men, link between laughter and hell. It says scientists now know the neutrino has mass, the most ghostly particle in the universe, one of them called it. No doubt other scientists are jealous who ask the right questions too late, some small failure of intuition leading them astray. No doubt, too, at this very moment, a snake is sunning itself in Calcutta. And somewhere a philosopher is erasing time's empty passing because he's seen a woman in a ravishing dress. In a different hour, he'll put it back. Read three or four more. At the risk of insulting some of your intelligences, I'll explain some references in this poem. Joan Sutherland is a famous opera singer. Foucault is a hot philosopher these days. Buster is my dog, Buster. Something like happiness. Last night, Joan Sutherland was nuancing the stratosphere on my fine-tuned tape deck. And there was my dog Buster with a flea rash, his head in his privates. Even for Buster, this was something like happiness. Elsewhere, I knew what people were doing to other people, the terrible hurts, the pleasures of hurting. I repudiated Zen because it doesn't provide for forgiveness, repudiated my friend X, who had gotten in touch with his feelings, which were spiteful and aggressive. Repudiate felt good in my mouth like someone else's tongue during the sweet combat of love. I said out loud, I repudiate, adding words like sincerity, correctness, common sense. I remember how tired I'd grown of mountaintops and their thin, unheavenly air. I'd grown tired, really, of how I spoke of them, the exaggerated glamour, the false equation between ascent and importance. I looked at the vase and its one red flower, then the table, which Zenists would say existed in its thisness, and realized how wrong it was to reject appearances, how much more difficult to accept them. I repudiated myself, citing my name. The phone rang. It was my overly serious friend from Syracuse saying, Foucault, Foucault, like some lost prayer of the tenured. Advocates of Advocates of Revolution, I agreed with him. Poor, screwed for years, angry. Who can begrudge them weapons and victory? But people like us, Joan Sutherland on our tapes, and enough fine time to enjoy her, I said. Let's be careful how we link thought and action. Careful about deaths we won't experience. I repudiated him and Foucault, told him that if Descartes were alive and wildly in love, he himself would repudiate his famous dictum. I felt something like happiness when he hung up, and Buster put his head on my lap and without admiration stared at me. I would not repudiate Buster, not even his fleas. How could I? Once a day, the flea travels to the eye of the dog for a sip of water. Imagine the journey, the delicacy of the arrival. Burying the cat. Her name was Isadora, and like all cats, she was a machine made of rubber bands and muscle, exemplar of crouch and pounce, genius of leisure. 17 years old. A neighbor dog had broken her back, and the owner called when he saw my car pull into the driveway. He'd put her in a plastic sack. It was ridiculous how heavy she was, how inflexible. For years I've known that to confess is to say what one doesn't feel. I hereby confess I was not angry with that dog, a shepherd, who had seen something foreign on his property. I'd like to say I was feeling a sadness so numb that I was a machine myself with bad cogs and faulty wiring. But I'm telling this 3 years after the fact. Nothing is quite what it was after we've formed a clear picture of it. Behind our house, there's a field, a half acre of grass, good for the sailing of a frisbee. I buried her there. My thought was to do it before the children came home from school, my wife from work. I got the shovel from the shed. The ground was not without resistance. I put several stones on top, pyramid style, a crude mausoleum. What we're mostly faced with are these privacies, inconsequential to all but us. But I wasn't thinking that then. I kicked some dirt off the shovel, returned it to the shed. I remember feeling that strange satisfaction I've often felt after yard work, some evidence of what I'd done visible for a change. I remember that after their shock, their grief, I expected to be praised. I just turned to another poem where I mentioned an animal, so I might as well read it. Backwaters. My dogs were dead and it was winter. I had no reason to walk the beach in brigantine, as if reasons mattered. Aren't they what we manufacture? The sea was white cap and wind, the gulls loners standing in groups, mild practitioners of avarice. I knew them well. Driftwood, as ever, vaguely resembled something intentional. For months now, crazed high school kids and postal clerks had been revealing what exists in the odd backwaters of their hearts. I'm sorry, I said to myself without apology, but it's all much worse than it's ever been. Brigantine, I heard prison and freedom in that name. Walking a beach, so-called, felt appropriately in between. In proper time, the cold, like conscience, urged me home. And I sought the calm on the lee side of the dunes. A used condom, two empty beer cans, lay in the indented sand. Even in winter, I thought, for a moment pleased, then felt in the presence of trash. I looked seaward, forced myself back out into the bracing wind. There at the end of a crude jetty made of rocks, a hooded man was staring into the monotony. You don't speak to a man like that. You give him all the room he needs. I'll conclude with this. called A Postmortem Guide, and it's subtitled For My Eulogist in Advance. Do not praise me for my exceptional serenity. Can't you see I've turned away from the large excitements and have accepted all the troubles? Go down to the old cemetery. You'll see there's nothing definitive to be said. The dead once were all kinds, boundary breakers and scallywags, martyrs of the flesh, and so many dumb bunnies of duty, unbearably nice. I've been a little of each. And please resist the temptation of speaking about virtue. The seldom tempted are too fond of that word, the small-spirited, the unburdened. Know that I've admired in others only the fraught straining to be good. Adam's my man, and Eve's not to blame. He bit in, it made no sense to stop. Still, for accuracy's sake, you might say I often stopped, that I rarely went as far as I dreamed. And since you know my hardships, understand their mere bump and setback against history's horror, remind those seated, perhaps weeping, how obscene it is for some of us to complain. Tell them I had second chances. I knew joy. I was burned by books early and kept sidling up to the flame. Tell them that at the end I had no need for God, who'd become just the story I once loved, one of many with concealments and late night rescues, high sentence and pomp. The truth is I learned to live without hope as well as I could, almost happily, in the despoiled and radiant now. You who are one of them, say that I loved my companions most of all. In all sincerity, say that they provided a better way to be alone. Thanks for listening.